Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org. WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You can get extremism on the far left, and you get it on the far right. It really comes down to what is the information that people are getting? What is the information that they are believing? And the guardrails fell off of that a long time ago in terms of helping Americans understand what the common set of sources are for factual information.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is Curious City. Extremism is on the rise. A bipartisan think tank in D.C. called the Center for Strategic and International Studies looked at 30 years of data on domestic terrorism. They found that since 2019, the number of domestic terrorist plots against government targets motivated by partisan political beliefs was nearly triple that of the last 25 years combined. So in other words, since the year 2000, domestic terrorist plots have been most concentrated in just the last 5 years or so. Last episode, we talked about Chicago's history with extremist groups, how they terrorized specific groups of people and influenced housing policy in the city. This episode, I'm talking with Odette Youssef. She's a national security correspondent focusing on extremism at NPR, about the rise of extremism today. You've been reporting on this beat for a long time. Tell me a little bit more about what specifically has changed in the last 5 years.
I mean, I've been on this beat for about 5 years, and I would say in that time, everything has changed. I think January 6th was a good example of how everything's changed. That, to me, really was a milestone in terms of how extremism looks in this country. Because, you know, I think we have long expected it to come out of small sort of cells or small groups. Mm-hmm. And here, it was just everyday Americans who had gotten really kind of radicalized to the point where they participated in the violence that day.
This is now effectively a riot. We have the police at the Capitol.
It's just sort of an information jungle out there. It's very difficult for many people to discern what is true and what is not true. And that is such a critical component of what is pushing Americans farther apart from each other.
And this is the America we live in today. In terms of extremism, Odette says we usually think of it as fringe, but that's a part of a common misconception.
Yeah, I think the popular understanding about extremism has long been that extremism looks like defined groups. And that it looks like groups that commit physical violence, right? Mm-hmm. But I think this isn't really quite how scholars and researchers, right, have long thought about extremism.
When you're trying to identify extremism, Odette says it's less useful to think about specific groups and more useful to think about the umbrella these groups are under and the project they're trying to accomplish.
These are movements, and there may be many groups that are within a movement, right? So within the organized white supremacist movement, you see lots of different groups. There were neo-Nazi skinheads, the KKK. Today, we have groups like Patriot Front, lots of different groups, but they are all working towards the same project, right? Which is like a white ethnostate.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of more what we're trying to understand is what's the project, what's the movement.
Odette also says that people who believe in extreme ideologies often have a stark division in their minds about who's in the in-group and who's in the out-group.
You know, that's really key because you'll see that in these extremist movements, the definition of who is allowed to be in charge or even part of society versus who isn't is really stark. Again, looking at the white nationalist movement, like that's very clear. Like if you're white, you're in the in-group. And if you're not, you're in the out-group. And to achieve power, it means committing harm against those who are in the out-group.
Mm.
Sometimes that is physical violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that also just looks like dehumanizing narratives about mm-hmm. people in the out-group. But sometimes it is conducted through policy, right? Like we think about the Jim Crow laws of the South, like these are laws that stripped people of rights, of equal treatment under the law.
Yeah. I wonder if you can, just go through some of the areas where we're seeing more extremist ideologies and strategies permeating our culture in the United States today.
If we're looking at efforts premised on creating clear in-groups and clear out-groups.
Mm-hmm.
We are seeing right now from the very top levels of federal government efforts to strip out anything relating to diversity in public institutions, also putting levers on private institutions to do the same. That can fall into this framework. You know, we saw just a couple of years ago, the reversal of Roe v. Wade, we saw women lose a constitutional right under the 14th Amendment. They had protection for abortion across the country. Now, that is something that also could be considered as an extremist project, although we haven't typically talked about the pro-life movement necessarily as extremist.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some who would fall to that sort of definition as evidence that perhaps it has been mischaracterized for decades.
Hmm.
You know, I feel like there are so many changes that are happening in this moment in the U.S. You know, we're seeing a lot of this attention being focused on genderqueer and trans people, restricting their ability to use public bathrooms, restricting their ability to participate in sports. All of this, I think, relates to ideologies that for a long time have been found in extremist movements.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's interesting that we're seeing them in policy.
Can you talk about how xenophobia has come up in this realm as well?
This was very interesting. Many years ago, I was doing interviews with somebody who had been involved and was trying to get out of a white nationalist organization. And when he was describing to me his descent into that world, he talked about Donald Trump's ride down the golden escalator when he announced that he was going to run for president the first time, and his characterization of immigrants as criminals and rapists.
Mm-hmm.
And the person that I was interviewing was like, wait, you're allowed to say that? Like, he was like, oh, wait, we're allowed to say that now?
Wow.
And so this narrative of immigrants who don't have status here as criminals, this is something that animated the Republican Party increasingly in the mm-hmm. run-up to this recent election. And right now, it is a major priority
mm-hmm.
to pursue these deportations, as we know, and to continue to justify them with the claim that many immigrants are engaged in criminal activity, when in fact we know that, you know, overwhelmingly immigrants in this country are law-abiding.
Odette, you mentioned earlier that one can find extremism both on the far left and on the far right. What are some recent examples of extremist movements on the far left?
So, you know, a lot of my coverage has actually focused on far-right extremism for the simple reason that what we've seen from data and from statements in testimony that former FBI Director Christopher Wray has given before Congress, when we're thinking about the most, in their words, persistent and lethal threat here in the homeland, they're looking at something called RMV, R-M-V-E, racially motivated violent extremists. The largest sort of most prominent sort of subcategory within that is white supremacist violence. Now, yes, I mean, when we look at the spectrum of ideologies that you might find, there is, of course, extremism on the left, as there is extremism on the right. But the focus that I've had has been on extremist violence that has been lethal. And that has been more common on the right than it has been on the left. Now, we've seen in sort of like the popular discourse a lot of talk about Antifa, which, you know, is actually much more nuanced, I would say, than the way that it is often spoken about. There's no one organization called Antifa. So like that makes it a little bit complicated to try to wrap your head around what that even is. I have spoken with Chicago police officers who've told me that they think that the movement for Black Lives should be designated as a domestic terrorist group. And again, you know, when I've talked about the violent extremism that I have focused on, we really are looking at the most violent pockets of extremism, which, as I mentioned, fall disproportionately to the right side of the political spectrum.
I want to put this in the context of Chicago. I'm thinking about the gender affirming care at Lurie Children's Hospital. Last month, they paused gender care surgeries for patients under age 19. And this happened a few days after there were threats to cut federal funding from providers who offer this type of care. Can you just talk about how this reflects the way that you've seen extremism take hold in our culture?
So Lurie was one of like several children's hospitals across the country. You'll remember this from a year or two ago, that was the target of bomb threats made after certain far-right influencers posted social media content, basically drawing attention to gender-affirming services at those hospitals. Now, fast forward to, you know, 2025, and we've seen this at some other major medical institutions as well, is sort of a pulling back of their services for gender-affirming care, because now you don't necessarily need the violent threats to make that change. Right now, it's the threat of losing federal funding that has applied the pressure. And so this is, you know, I think kind of illustrative of how the violence really is a tool to get to the goal, but policy could be another tool if you have people with close proximity to power.
Yeah. Other issues that have been coming up in and around Chicago have been book banning debates in libraries around the city, bathrooms, dressing rooms, and schools. Of course, Chicago has been a target for mass deportations by ICE. But generally, Chicago and the state of Illinois have been resistant to some of the ideology that has come up through and leading up to this current administration. And I wonder if you can talk about how Chicago fits into the national leanings toward a more extremist ideology.
Well, what I can say is that Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, diverse large cities have always been animating talking points on the far right because they are Democratic strongholds and because they are diverse. I think these big cities have always sort of been a problem or a thorn in the side of these movements because, frankly, I think they often show that diversity is not harmful, that, you know, these are places where we all have to actually rely on each other to some extent to make things work. And that is an unsettling reality to people that are trying to sell the notion that the ideal future will come about only if everybody worships the same way or only if everybody has the same skin color. Like, that's a deeply troubling reality. And so that's why you see, like, the amplification of when things bad happen in Chicago. And you don't necessarily see, like, the positives of the city, like, held up.
Yeah. Zooming out a little bit, why do you think extremism has been talked about as sort of a fringe, on the margins, small individual group kind of thing, when in actuality it's quite different from that?
I think that extremism, like when we're talking about the ideologies, I think historically they have been on the fringe. The accepted range of discussion on so many issues used to be a lot tighter than it is now. And I think a lot of things have changed that. I think COVID was a more deeply destabilizing phenomenon than I think most people still even realize. You know, what underlies a lot of extremist movements, they rely on conspiracy theories in order for people to get on board. And COVID was so destabilizing to people that I think a lot of them lost trust in institutions and got on board with conspiracy theories. And the thing about conspiracy theories is that it's a slippery slope. You know, once you start to believe one thing, you can get pulled further into another.
With all of this kind of 2020, 2019 and forward era of change when it comes to extremism in this country, how has this affected the way that people address and combat extremism? Like, and by people, I mean like organizations working on this, but also journalists even.
So I think, frankly, using the term extremism can be problematic, right? Because, you know, I think that in itself is a turnoff. If you want to have discussions that help people see each other as humans again. So, you know, some people are talking about this as polarization. Whatever you call it, you have to approach it from the understanding that, like, people are adopting worldviews that may be dehumanizing to each other because they found a community that's doing that, that they feel accepted in. And so, how do we get to a place where we're able to talk across the divide in a way that, like, may hold people accountable for the harm they may have done, but also lets them know that as they work through that, they will be welcomed back into society? Like, there is a way back. And I don't think we've seen a scalable representation of how to do that. In some other countries, especially in Europe, there is substantial government investment in what are called like de-radicalization programs. Here, you know, we've never really had that. It butts up against, you know, First Amendment rights. And I think we have reached a point right now where it's almost like ridiculous to even talk about that kind of a thing, just because these divisions have soaked so thoroughly into our everyday politics here. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm a little bit doomsday over here. Like, I truly don't see how that gets done in a peaceable way.
Odette Youssef is a national security correspondent focusing on extremism at NPR. Odette, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There are groups working to counteract the rise of extremism. One is Life After Hate, which helps people break free from their lives of violent hate and extremism. The Southern Poverty Law Center has a guide for parents, teachers, and caregivers about online radicalization. And a few years ago, Illinois passed a law that requires public high schools to teach media literacy. This episode of Curious City was produced by me and Justin Bull. Mary Hall is our digital producer. Susie Ahn is our editor. Curious City is a production of WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you have questions about Chicago and the region, send them our way at curiouscity@wbez.org or visit us at wbez.org/curiouscity. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week.
Rise and shy. WBEZ is serving local stories for breakfast every weekday morning from 5 to 11. Tune in on the WBEZ app to hear what Chicago's talking about as you start your day.